Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Nearly every major faith tradition that I can think of has exhortations to help the poor and needy amongst us. That is certainly a noble goal that few would object to, although our political rhetoric often paints different factions within our society with the brushstrokes of being uncaring to those who are in need. In reality, many of our political debates are not about whether we should care for the needy, but rather how. Here in the United States, as in many other nations around the world, political factions can be divided into two broad groups. One group favoring government action to redistribute resources so as to alleviate poverty and suffering, and another group that advocates a more private action, be it individual charity or spurring economic growth through entrepreneurial activity with the assertion that doing so will benefit a wide swath of the population. Religious figures have often waded into this debate. Pope Leo XIII was one of the first pontiffs to issue an encyclical about the economic conditions of the Industrial Revolution that he was witnessing in Europe in the late 19th century. This encyclical was known as Rerum Novarum. In contemporary times, U.S. Catholic bishops have also released letters concerning how economic resources in society should be distributed, most notably back in 1986 with a document entitled Economic Justice for All. Both of these documents argued for greater government intervention into the economy, albeit still affirming the importance of private property. In the 1960s and 70s, a group of primarily Catholic and some Protestant theologians drafted up a set of ideas that would become known as liberation theology, a philosophy that drew upon Marxist and neo-Marxist thinking and advocated for much greater state intervention into the economy, with some theologians even advocating socialist ownership of the means of production. The notion that Christian charity for the poor should be carried out via government fiat has not been left unchallenged, though. A number of Christian thinkers and economists have argued that government intervention into the economy with the ostensible purpose of helping the poor via the redistribution of wealth can actually alter economic incentives in such a manner that the poor may actually be made worse off. In contrast to liberation theology, these folks often advocate something that has been termed libertarian theology. Today we talk with one such economist, Professor Art Cardin of Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. Art is an assistant professor in the Brock School of Business there and one of a growing number of economists starting to examine the intersection of economics and religion. He is also a senior research fellow at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, as well as being a research fellow at the Independent Institute. Professor Cardin writes extensively on numerous topics, including economic development throughout history, the effect that large box stores such as Walmart have on local economic and social development in our contemporary world, and as we shall talk about here, the issue of religion as it pertains to the economy. Art came to my attention via one of my friends on Facebook, and I was directed to an interesting paper he wrote called Christian Ethics, Formal Institutions, and Economic Growth, published in the Annual Review of Political Economy. Speaking of Facebook, I do want to direct our new and regular listeners to our Facebook fan page, where you can get neat previews of things that are to come on our show. We almost have 300 likes, and I'd like to reach that goal by Thanksgiving, so please give me a reason to be thankful by stopping by our page and becoming our friend. We will be sure to return our love. Art, hey, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
I hear you have a big neck injury, so you're really kind of gritting your teeth to get through this interview, I hear.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what happened. I woke up yesterday morning and laid on the couch for a couple of minutes before my son got up, and I don't know what happened.
Well, we thank you again for making your time to do this. You wrote this paper here about Christian ethics and economics, and it's pretty relevant for today's world because we're in the midst of what's being called the Great Recession. Times are tough, and so I'm digging into your paper expecting you to tell me about how tough times are, but you don't do that, actually. You're an economic historian, so you're telling me that things are pretty good today. So what is all that about?
Well, they are, And in the paper you're referencing, in an ongoing project I'm working on for the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, and in a handful of other things, one of my goals is to kind of demonstrate to people just how great things are when viewed in a deep historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
As the economic historian Deidre McCluskey points out, in light of the Great Recession, you know, things will flatten out for a few years, and then we'll have a new all-time peak achievement for human well-being and economic growth, an all-time record for life expectancy, again, within the next few years. I tell people from time to time that today is the greatest day to be alive in the history of the world.
Really?
And just a simple look around shows why that's the case. There's obviously going to be some variation. You know, for example, like you mentioned, I woke up yesterday morning with my neck killing me, and I would much prefer having woken up Saturday morning, or how I woke up Saturday morning without said neck injury. But
mm-hmm.
Deep down, life is fantastic. I can go to the doctor here in a little bit and see if they can take care of me. I just got my new iPhone 5. I have three children who are very, very healthy. That's not going to be true of everybody, obviously, but the average person's standard of living is so much greater than it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, to say nothing of 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, that it just defies belief almost.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. When you start to think about the dawn of human history, I mean, life was really, really miserable. We were pretty much living, you know, like dogs trying to scrape by on a day-to-day basis. And then about 10,000 years ago, you had the agrarian revolution that made things a little bit better, but we still had these, you know, ups and downs in economies. People would, do very well for a time, and empire would expand, and there'd be a bubonic plague or something like that. We would crash, and, you know, life kind of pretty much sucked until about 200 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It was life was nasty, life was brutish, and life was short. At the height of the Roman Empire, life expectancy was 24. Today, it's in the 70s. I fully expect my kids, who are 4, 2, and 4 months old, to live to be 90 if nothing ultimately gets in the way. Our ability to enjoy life today is far greater than it has ever been. Again, just to consider some of the things that are, you know, perhaps more important than just economic growth, thinking about family and things of that nature. The likelihood that a woman dies in childbirth today is, in a Western country like the United States, for all intents and purposes, it's so close to zero that a lot of people just don't even worry about it. That is fundamentally different when compared to the rest of history. I don't expect to ever have to bury one of my own children, which that would have been a fairly commonplace occurrence just 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago. Life is far better than it's ever been. And if we take our eyes off the proverbial ball, we can wreck the institutional and cultural framework that's helped to make that happen.
Yeah, that's a really important issue. And this is one thing that I emphasize with my students. So not only do I teach religion and politics, but I teach political economy classes. Mm-hmm. And students, their historical knowledge of the world is basically from when they're born to when they still exist. And that's, I think, true for a lot of us. And, you know, we see the last couple of years, it's like, oh, you know, I haven't been able to get a job. Things are not really good. Wow, we better change everything we're doing in the opposite direction. And you stop and you think, well, you know, in a broader perspective, if this is just a little dip, almost a statistical fluctuation that's somewhat random due to, you know, confluence of different factors, maybe other policy factors or things like this. But if you look at it in the broad perspective and we switch everything we're doing, we might actually drive ourselves in the opposite direction.
Right, right. Now, I don't expect us to. And obviously, life is hard for a lot of people.
Right.
Life's a lot harder than it could be. Indeed, you know, another thing that I tell people is I fully expect my children's standard of living when they're my age to be much higher than my standard of living is right now.
I was going to say that's very interesting. I just want to stop you there because a lot of our debates nowadays, we've just been through the midst of a big, huge political campaign. Now, mm-hmm. we are recording this prior to the election. This will be airing after the election. But, you know, a lot of people are talking about, no, the economy is so bad. You know, I can't imagine my children living better than me today. We're kind of at our peak living standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, people say that every generation.
Yeah.
And every generation, they're wrong. Now, while I do expect my kids to have a much higher standard of living than I do, their standard of living will not be as high as it could have been in the absence of some fairly serious policy mistakes that people have made.
Uh-huh.
Now, consider just some of the stuff that we take for granted today. The big events that go on in the technological universe are, whenever Apple reveals a new product, or Microsoft has just come out with their Surface tablet, or whenever there's a new Android device or something like that. Innovation, which is fairly unique historically and largely limited, again, to the last several centuries, is something we just take for granted today. We just assume that every year there's going to be a newer, better iPhone, or a newer, better iPad, or Microsoft is going to come up with something that is better than what they had before. And again, these are the sorts of things that are unique.
Yeah, that certainly hasn't happened for most of history. There's been innovations. There's been the innovation of the deep plow or the stirrup or a number of different things like that, but it happens on a very slow and gradual pace. About 200 years ago, maybe 250 or so years ago, however you want to date the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, human society broke out of this, specifically in Western Europe. And right. And you write about this, and again, understanding the perspective that things are much better than they were for the vast majority of human history, and 200, 250 years ago it started changing, keeps things in perspective. But here's the critical question. What happened 200, 250 years ago that gave rise to this dramatic change in the way we live?
Okay, so that's a fantastic question. Let me preface it with a little bit of context. First, over the summer, I read a fantastic book by Stephen Kotler and Peter Diamandis called Abundance. And basically, they make all a series of sort of futurist projections about how abundance really is our future. And if I'm remembering this correctly, they said that I'm thinking off the top of my head, so I may not have the numbers right, like precisely correct, but from, say, the dawn of human history until, say, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, humans produced about 5 exabytes of digital information. So something like 1 billion gigabytes of information. And then as of a couple of years ago, they were producing that every 2 weeks. They projected, writing in 2010, that by 2012, I think people would be producing that much information about every 10 minutes.
Hmm.
So our ability to produce information has increased dramatically. And to contextualize what I'm about to say, in light of the fact that we're producing so much information so rapidly and so much new scholarship so rapidly, obviously my views on this have evolved since I wrote the first draft of this paper as a graduate student. And I think there are two fundamental things that have happened. The first is we got the rules right, and the second is that we have gotten the rhetoric right.
Mm-hmm.
So getting the rules right is the institutional perspective. Basically, we figured out the rules of free market capitalism. Secure private property rights, honest government, political stability, a dependable legal system, open and competitive markets.
Uh-huh.
That is literally, those 5 things are literally straight out of the textbook from which I teach my intro course. Getting the rhetoric right, however, is probably a little bit more controversial in the scholarly community, but Deidre McCluskey, in her ongoing series of books on what she calls the bourgeois era, argues that we finally... people began to finally esteem merchants, not merely tolerate merchants and tolerate trade, but actually esteem them, esteem the bourgeois virtues, or esteem bourgeois activity as something that actually was a positive social good.
Now, I want to stop you here because I like that division that you're talking about here, the difference between getting the rules right and getting the rhetoric right. They're both interrelated, I think, to a large extent,
oh, yeah,
because the ability to convince people that these are the set of rules that are really good and stick with those rules is going to be very important in fostering innovation. But let's first stick with these rules. You mentioned a couple of these. One of these, a lot of my listeners are not economists, they're not
right.
Economic historians, so they might be a little bit, in the air about what you're talking about here. Getting the rules right, let's talk about that. What do you mean by some of these things that you talk about, getting property rights secured? Why does that matter?
Well, secure private property rights are important because if you own it, then you have an incentive to improve it. That's one of the main and major things. If you have private ownership of something, you have incentives to improve it, you have incentives to do what you can to earn income from it, and so on and so forth. Indeed, you have incentives to conserve when you have secure private property rights. A friend of mine actually won an award for a short little note that he wrote on teaching environmental economics using the book The Lorax.
Mm.
I haven't seen the new movie, but... So apparently in The Lorax, the Onceler cuts down all of his truffula trees because his stock price goes up, and he learns that, lo and behold, he should have been more environmentally friendly. The issue there is that if those were the Wunsler's truffula trees, then his stock price would not have gone up were he clear cutting his only valuable asset.
Because it would have been gone in the future. Nobody wants to invest in the future.
Yeah, exactly. So if you can own something, you have incentives to conserve. You have incentives to improve. When you don't own stuff, and this is a problem when we have common property, we run into what's called the tragedy of the commons, which is if the Wunsler just comes across a commonly owned field of truffula trees, then in that case he has incentives to clear cut everything he can, because if he doesn't, somebody else will. In that sense, secure private property rights are essential to maintaining our stock of productive assets.
Yeah, so if I own that thing of trees, I'm not familiar with the Lorax that much, so I don't know what kind of trees they are, but you know, if I own those trees, I'm going to make sure I'm going to regrow some so that in the following year and the year after I can continue to make money or make resources off them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Yeah, absolutely. So consider what happens when you rent a car. Yeah, no one's going to take a rental car through a car wash,
mm-hmm.
for example. Or ideally you'll treat a rental car as if it were your own, but most people are probably not going to be as careful with a rental car as they are with their own. Now, granted, rental car companies and whatnot have evolved rules and institutions to help to deal with that, but nonetheless, the fact remains: you're generally more careful with your stuff than you are with other people's stuff.
Okay, so that's secure property rights, and I can already start to see how rhetoric is going to be important here, because if there are people, you know, specifically when we get into this issue of Christian ethics, you know, do we advocate for social ownership or not, this could turn the way incentives are structured in society if we move away from private property rights. How about some of the other stuff that matters in society, these rules that you talked about that we got right 200 years ago or so?
Yeah, so corruption is kind of an interesting thing. In general, we think that corruption is a bad thing. I've done a little bit of work, and a number of people have done some work too, so I'm not alone on this, arguing that in relatively low economic freedom environments, so places that have relatively little economic freedom, corruption can actually be growth increasing because it helps people get around really, really, really bad rules.
Mm-hmm.
In general, though, a relatively low corruption environment in a country like the United States or in countries like Western Europe, where the rules are generally pretty good, generally tends to increase people's degree of certainty about the risks that they're facing. Similarly with political stability.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively few people are going to invest in war-torn countries where you don't know who the government is going to be next week, next month, etc. In the U.S. and in Western Europe, for example, we have the kind of continuity that allows people to make long-run investments. It's not perfect, obviously, but for the most part, I don't worry about being wholly expropriated if, say, Barack Obama is reelected or if Mitt Romney is elected. Once all is said and done, I pretty much expect my life on the day after the election to be a lot like my life on the day before the election.
Mm-hmm. And that's because just the general rules and institutions that we have here, writ large, are fairly stable as compared to policy. I mean, I know many people talk about policy uncertainty. Is the tax rate going to be, 35% or 37% next year? And that can have a influence, maybe not on the grand scale of things, but in terms of incentivizing production one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. The founding fathers were very wise when they strove to create a nation of laws and not of men. Because in a nation of laws, you more or less know what's going to happen. You have, again, relative security in your property. You have relatively little uncertainty about the investment climate, and you can do things like issue 30-year bonds or used to be 100-year bonds and things like that to finance railroad projects and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
The major institutional thing that we've gotten right in the Western world, for the most part, is open and competitive markets. And again, like I said, this is by no means perfect. If you look at trends in the U.S., in the 1950s, as I understand it, about one in every 20 American workers needed a license to do his or her job, and that's gone to about one in three now, according to a recent study from the Institute for Justice. But in general, one thing that we've gotten right is whoever goes out and builds the proverbial better mousetrap can get rich or can get very, very wealthy by doing it. For the most part, people don't have to get a whole lot in the way of permissions from the government in order to enter the market, and that is the thing that helps to produce the kind of innovation that we take for granted today.
Yeah, you know, one of the things you talk about in terms of that too is exchange. Talk about markets. The big issue here is exchange, specifically impersonal economic exchange. Why is exchange important? We oftentimes, again, when we get to rhetoric, we think about redistribution and ways to do that.
Right.
But this issue, underlying issue of impersonal exchange, is very important in what you talk about.
Yeah. Well, so this is one of the things that is essential to a well-functioning economic environment. And getting people to understand that trade is mutually beneficial is unfortunately very, very difficult. But nonetheless, the fact that trade creates wealth is one of the bedrock principles that helps to create a wealthy society.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, when two people trade, they give up something that they're kind of, not terribly enthusiastic about for something that they're more enthusiastic about. So they get something they prefer to whatever it is that they gave up. They can also become more productive. And this is usually like chapter two of almost any Principles of Economics book, mm-hmm. is the law of comparative advantage. Basically, when we're able to specialize, when we're able to divide labor, when we're able to trade, we can get more output using the same inputs. Or as Matt Ridley put it in his 2010 book, The Rational Optimist, he talked about how humans are the only species that will really trade. So when we trade, we save time. And in saving that time, we're able to use that time to innovate. We're able to use that time to build the better mousetrap. We're able to use that time to get much, much, much richer.
Yeah, that is, again, a very important issue when we talk about trade. The exchange between individuals does give us that incentive to actually do things. Because like, oh, you have a bunch of stuff that I want, but I'm not very good at making it. I make something very good that you want, so I'll make that and trade. And so that does, it makes us more efficient. And as you say, it also helps us conserve our resources much better. So let's get to this issue of rhetoric.
Yeah.
Because thinking about this issue of trade, and you mentioned free trade and open markets, there are people that say, oh, free trade is horrible. It destroys lives. And we talk about private property rights. Oh my gosh, private property rights. People just hoard their stuff. They're greedy. They don't use it all. That rhetoric oftentimes gets people a little bit froggy about some of these institutions that you talk about. And again, I'm somebody who teaches political economy. You are somebody as well. And you probably see this amongst your undergraduate students, trying to get them to, understand a free market can actually benefit people. They're like, no, it can't, because there's greed out there. And so it's difficult. So tell us a little bit about what you've been thinking about getting the rhetoric right. What does that mean?
Yeah, so building on McCluskey, and again, this is something that people who are contributing to this literature is still kind of an open issue. I think that there definitely is a lot to the cultural environment in terms of what ultimately helps to produce and what ultimately helps to create economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
I think the sad fact that I think we run into when we teach political economy is that a lot of people think that the problem is the disposition of the actors in society. That if people were just less greedy, if people were just less bad, then everything would be great and everything would be wonderful. If we all just cared a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
then things would be great. This though helps us to examine and I think fully appreciate the genius of writers like Adam Smith and Friedrich Hayek, and Thomas Sowell in his book A Conflict of Visions explains this quite nicely. You just kind of take people as they are. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing we can do to change that. And the question is not, do we have the right kind of people, but rather, do we have the right kind of social institutions to channel the fact that people are generally going to be self-interested and people are very, very limited in the knowledge that they bring to the table. How can we devise and develop institutions that will channel that into a productive society? In terms of rhetoric, one thing that I know the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics is doing is trying to help convince people that you don't have to go into vocational ministry in order to be a minister. And this is something I spend a decent amount of time talking to my students at Samford about, and some of the students with whom I work, or some of the folks with whom I go to church. Going into the vocational ministry is fine and fantastic, but one can be every bit as much a minister just by working at McDonald's and showing up to work on time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, my own pastor said that the other morning as well. He says, I don't have that much impact because all you are coming pretty much with the same message online here in our auditorium, but you know, you got to get out there in the real world and really do make this happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the issue that makes this difficult, I think, though, is the difference between that which is seen and that which is unseen.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my favorite essays is Friedrich Bastiat's essay, That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen. And it's very, very easy to see the intended beneficiaries of compassion. And I'm sure you've seen this before. Yeah? With a missions organization, we'll have the pictures of the people who go out into the international missions field, and here they are digging a well or building a hut or painting a church or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all very, very, very easy to see. What's not easy to see, though, is the additional increases in human well-being that would come from the fact that, say, for example, let's suppose that Target comes up with a slightly easier way to check people out at the front of the store.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to this in part because their CEO was more relaxed one day because the barista at his normal Starbucks is just completely and totally on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And so the person who's pouring coffee for the CEO of Starbucks is helping to contribute to an almost impossible to see, but nonetheless very, very real, increase in everybody's standard of living. So live long and prosper might be sound theological advice.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, how you talk about things seen and unseen. And I do think this fits into our rhetoric. You do, see people arguing for greater compassion because you say, well, look at these people who are suffering, and you have self-interested people who are ignoring them. There's a really interesting example of this, too, that came about in the recent Haitian earthquake. That there was a lot of people who, saw the pictures of people in Haiti, their homes have been destroyed, and people were looking pretty miserable. That's the stuff that's seen. And then all of a sudden, people are coming by with charitable donations, namely clothes. I mean, the clothes were coming in by the boatloads, and they were just being unloaded. You saw people reaching out to the trucks that were unloading the stuff and really happy. The unseen thing, though, was real interesting in that the Haitian economy really relies a great deal on textiles.
Mm-hmm.
And the Haitian government, after a week or two of all these donations of clothing came in, was saying, no, don't bring this stuff in. Yeah, I know it looks really nice. I know it looks really kind, but it's devastating our textile industry because now people are just basically buying and reselling this stuff. And so businesses that were destroyed and wanted to get back off the ground and would be, helping to employ people, all of a sudden they're stagnating.
Yeah, well, two of the best books that I've read on Christian charity and economics are When Helping Hurts by Stephen Corbett and Brian Fickert, and Toxic Charity by Robert Lupton. And they talk about these sorts of phenomena, where often, sort of in our rush to do good, Westerners don't know what's needed on the ground. After the Haitian earthquake, on a handful of economic development blogs, there's some pretty good posts about what not to do for Haiti. Don't donate clothing. Don't go to Haiti. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. Because often we, in our rush to do good, we actually end up making people worse off on net. I would ask a question that may provoke the ire of a lot of evangelicals like myself, which would be, well, why are people in Haiti suffering? And what can we do about it? And I think one thing that the West ultimately has to be accountable for is our immigration policy.
Mm.
We could take great strides to reduce global poverty by opening up our borders. Indeed, in his book, Let Their People Come, the economist Lant Pritchett talks about how open immigration would be orders of magnitude better for the poor than aid, than even free trade or any of a number of other things. And the kicker there is it's pretty close to a free lunch for the West as well, because the average immigrant to the United States would be either at the very, very top of the skill distribution or the very, very bottom of the skill distribution, and would bring skills that are complementary to American skills. So we get richer, they get richer, we take great strides toward ending poverty, and unfortunately, that's a set of policy prescriptions that's just, quite honestly and unfortunately, not very popular.
And that part, in part, goes back to this whole issue of getting the rhetoric right, is that, you know, people perceive of immigration as you're taking away somebody else's job.
Right.
And actually, it's interesting the way that you talked about it, and we were talking about exchange earlier. Actually, immigration is really just an exchange issue. We're exchanging some labor, you know, up here in the United States for something else and just kind of trading. And people don't see it that way. I know there's let me bring it around to the religion aspect here a little bit and the issue of Christian ethics, because our show is called Research on Religion. I could talk economics all day, but we are at bottom line issue about religion. And there's this whole issue about Christian charity. And it comes up with this issue. Now, a lot of the Christian rhetoric is about, let's welcome in immigrants because it's caring and we need to help, you know, provide them with jobs. But then on the other hand, you hear many of the same leaders saying, oh, but, you know, they'll be given cheap jobs and the labor will be exploited. And so therefore we need things like minimum wage laws. And so the rhetoric, again, starts to shape our policy, and it can, in what you would say, somehow distort the institution. So give us a sense of, you talk about this in your paper too, the issue of price controls, not only on prices of the goods of things, but also prices of labor in terms of minimum wage laws. Tell us a little bit about how the rhetoric affects, and especially Christian ethic rhetoric, bishops saying we need minimum wage laws or we need living wage laws, how that can affect the things that are seen and unseen.
So one of the most important lessons of any economics class is the law of unintended consequences. And indeed, especially at a Christian school like Samford, this is one of the things I'm trying to really convey to people, is that merely meaning to do well does not mean doing well, or merely meaning to help people does not mean actually helping people. And in the case of something like a price control, so with Hurricane Sandy bearing down on the East Coast right now, price gouging laws are actually going to create and exacerbate shortages. And these kinds of things ultimately delay the recovery process.
Okay, let me stop you here, because the price gouging issue is one that I use with my students to illustrate things too, and it's a great one. We'll come back to the minimum wage and living wage laws in a minute, but yeah, Hurricane Sandy hitting the East Coast right now, and people are going to lose electricity, and so one of the things that's going to be in high demand are generators, and you know, there will undoubtedly be some news person out there going, you know, to somebody who's selling generators that may have been $500 last week, now selling them for $1,500, three times the price. They'll go, oh my gosh, how uncompassionate you are. This is horrible. We need laws that prevent this thing. That, so if a disaster comes, you have to sell that generator at the same exact price as it was the week before the emergency. What's wrong? I mean, that sounds caring. That's very Christian. We need to help the poor. The poor in the time of great emergency need, they're up to their knees in water and their puppy dogs are wet and they need electricity to dry them off. Sounds so cruel. Come on, Art. What, you're just being cruel.
Okay, you're right, clearly, right? Because this is the inevitable objection that comes up in any discussion like this is, okay, so why do you hate poor people?
Uh-huh.
And I think the response is, well, no, we don't. In fact, the laws of supply and demand tell us that when you hold a price below that which will clear on below that which would obtain on the market, then you get shortages. So it's very easy to rattle our sabers, and it's very, very easy to condemn people who are raising prices of gasoline generators, for example, or plywood or anything like that. But that's just cheap talk. It's really, really easy for me to sit in my very comfortable office in Birmingham, Alabama, and and just sort of make big, bold statements about the wrong that other people are doing. So let's consider the seller of gas generators. And so let's assume, so Hurricane Sandy hits, and there's a massive, massive shortage of gasoline generators on the East Coast. The person who buys generators takes them into the hurricane-affected area and sells them for three times what he paid for them in, say, a city like Nashville or Columbus, Ohio, or Cleveland. is someone who is actually working to alleviate the suffering of the people who are on the ground.
Hmm.
I'm just sitting in my office in Birmingham. I'm doing nothing for the people who are being most affected by the storm. Indeed, in the absence of freely fluctuating prices, and again, the textbook I use refers to a price as an incentive wrapped up in a signal, or excuse me, a signal wrapped in an incentive. In the absence of freely fluctuating prices, I don't get the information I need to conserve the resources that might be better used in the disaster-prone areas. So if gas were allowed to jump up to $5, $6 a gallon on the East Coast, what would that do to gas prices in Birmingham? Presumably that would raise gas prices in Birmingham, and I would think twice about some of the trips that I'm going to take.
And that's actually kind of a nice thing. It's like, you know what, I don't need that extra trip to the museum or that when people on the East Coast need this gasoline for something else. And
right.
So, you're not necessarily donating that gasoline, mm-hmm. but that gasoline is being shipped to its higher valued use.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that prices do that a lot of people, unfortunately, just don't appreciate,
yeah.
is prices economize on and transmit valuable information about the scarcity of goods in different markets. When we don't let prices work, then people have incentives. People in non-affected areas have incentives to use resources wastefully.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, I understand that with generators, right? That let me press you on that issue of generators a little bit more, because when I discuss this with my students, the issue always comes up and say, well, yeah. The price of generators goes up and, three times. And so there's people from Cleveland and Memphis who are driving generators out there to sell them at that higher price, the price they're working. But what about that poor guy who needs to chill his insulin, who, needs this generator right away and can't afford it? And there's some real uber rich fat cat that is only going to want to chill his expensive champagne. And he buys the generator for $1,500. Is that really a better use in terms of, don't we feel as Christians affected by this? That poor guy that, only has $500 cannot buy this generator now because the fat cat is buying it for $1,500, the last generator sold.
Well, okay, so that's those sorts of lifeboat situations are obviously difficult. And it's clear, even though we can't fully articulate this, I think most of us have some sort of internal intuition that, or at least some sort of moral revulsion at the idea that the fat cat who wants to chill his champagne is really and truly the high-valued user of a generator relative to someone who needs to cool his insulin. It's true that might be a possible objection, but I would be shocked if that sort of thing actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
I believe people are basically sinful, and there's no... I think history has taught us that there's no bottom when you consider the depths of human depravity. But when it comes to taking care of people who are genuinely in need, I think people tend to rise up and take care of that. And I honestly doubt that anybody's going to say, look, I know that you need to chill your insulin, but I'm going to take this generator and go chill my champagne.
Yeah, there is that interesting aspect to this all, even though
a particularly unlikely scenario, I think.
Yeah, even though in economics we talk a lot about self-interest, which a lot of people attribute as the same thing as greed, and I don't think those things are exactly the same. And this, again, gets back to this issue of rhetoric that we're talking about. But even though we're self-interested individuals, there are these moments of altruism. And I think it's actually a great puzzle for economists to figure out how these two things blend and work together. Yes, we are sinful creatures, but you know what? We're also creatures that try to fight against sin, that we try to overcome sin on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, and that raises a puzzle that I don't think really has an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably we should be able to anticipate that, in situations like Hurricane Sandy or hurricanes that pop up periodically along the Gulf Coast, that you're going to have these problems with people who end up stuck, with people who have insulin who need to chill, the person who needs to chill his or her insulin.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably that's going to be, that person is going to be out there in these sorts of situations, these sorts of scenarios. One would think that we can anticipate that and find some way to find some way to address the problem before it becomes a true emergency.
Mm-hmm.
In her book, The Cultural and Political Economy of Recovery, Emily Shamley Wright discusses post-Katrina recovery in and around New Orleans, and she paints a very different picture of what happened in New Orleans after the hurricane than what a lot of people might be familiar with. Because I think the popular image of post-disaster recovery or of post-disaster scenarios is these utterly helpless, completely disheveled people who are waiting for sort of an army of people in matching T-shirts to ride in on their white horses and save everything. Mm-hmm. And that's not what happens. That's not what happens in relatively robust communities. And Emily Shamley Wright talks about how these various communities came together and solved some of the very, very serious collective action problems that emerged after Hurricane Katrina. And I think civil society is far more robust in a free society than we give it credit for being.
Yeah, that's true. And in terms of the rhetoric that goes on too, and I want to get back to this issue of rhetoric, because we have, you know, Christian leaders saying, oh, how uncaring and uncompassionate that we took so long to get into Katrina at the one level, and we need more centralized government planning, for instance, to deal with this issue, how uncompassionate you could be. But in reality, what's happening at the local level is that Christian compassion is kicking in right there at the grassroots and solving these problems that the seen and unseen things that we don't see that. And, you know, part this might be, you know, the media likes to feature people who are suffering rather than people who are doing pretty good.
Right.
So
yeah, and this is something that economists have referred to from time to time as the Nirvana fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
To merely say I wish the world were this way is not going to be sufficient to make the world that way. And indeed, when you look at things like government responses to natural disasters, the problem is not one of political will. The problem is getting the incentives and the institutions right. And there's so much political nastiness tied up in disaster recovery that it's often, and I would indeed say usually, a cure that's worse than the disease.
Yeah, so that's emergencies, that's disasters, and okay, we can understand that. But what about compassion for people on a daily basis? Because you know what, I've been hearing that, you know, in a market economy, you have self-interested profit maximizers who want to make as much money for their business as they can, and they're going to squeeze laborers. They're basically squeezing blood out of a turnip in that, and they're going to keep wages low. And if wages are low, people are not going to be able to feed their families, to chill their insulin and all those other things. So a number of Christian ethicists, including we talked about the Catholic bishops' pastoral letter that they issued in 1986, Economic Justice for All, advocate for things such as minimum wage laws or a living wage laws. And again, that sounds great. I mean, how could anybody object to that?
Because the law of unintended consequences rears its ugly head here as everywhere. In fact, I was talking with a colleague the other day who's leading a tutorial for some students on religion and economics, and she pointed out that, you know, in one of the things they were reading, that apparently economists who work at this intersection of religion and theology know a lot more about theology, at the intersection of economics and theology, know a lot more about theology than theologians at this intersection know about economics.
Uh-huh.
And here's where things get interesting. In the case of something like minimum wages, when you hold a price above what the market will bear, you get surpluses or you get unemployment. So basically, minimum wages destroy opportunities for the very, 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 very poor. Things like laws against sweatshops internationally destroy the best of a bunch of what are probably very bad options, but the best, nonetheless, for some of the poorest people in the world. I would argue that it is irresponsible to make such pronouncements about what wage policy should be without at the very least, a simple understanding of how competitive markets work.
Nonetheless, you have these theologians advocating for it, and you made a very interesting statement, is that in this intersection of religion and politics, the economists know more about theology than the theologians know about economics, yet the theologians have no problem stepping into the arena and influencing the way things are mentioned in terms of their rhetoric. Why do you think that is?
Again, because it's So Brian Kaplan, in his book The Myth of the Rational Voter, refers to what he calls rational irrationality. And he basically says most people have irrational beliefs about economics. They don't understand trade. They don't understand competition. But they also have no incentive to update those beliefs. Mm-hmm. Because it's very, very easy to, again, sit in my office in Birmingham and make pronouncements about how other people should live. But it's much, much, much more difficult to really understand something as abstract and difficult and complicated as basic price theory.
So are you advocating for economics classes in the seminary?
I honestly don't think that would be a bad idea.
Really?
Really. I think this is an area about which I'm particularly passionate because a lot of times when we go in with guns blazing as Christians and say, you know, we're going to implement these policies that are not consistent with basic economics, we end up doing a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
We end up hurting exactly the people that we think we're helping.
Yeah, just like as we mentioned in Haiti or
right.
minimum wage laws, we unemploy
right.
a lot of people, sure.
Right, yeah, exactly. I can't feed, clothe, and shelter my family with your good intentions. I need real resources to do that. And it's one thing to make a policy that hurts me, specifically Art Carden in Birmingham, Alabama, because, yeah, it's... As things go, I have a relatively comfortable life. You know, if something happens that costs me a few $1,000s a year, I'll miss it a little bit, but it's not going to be, it's not going to be a life ender. You know, for people at the very, very margins of society, for people at the very margins of subsistence, you're talking about literally life and death scenarios with respect to public policy. The economist Justin Ross, who teaches in the policy school at Indiana University, gave a presentation to his graduate students one year, where he talked about economics being about how not to kill people,
mm-hmm.
or economics being the art of not killing people with your good intentions.
Mm.
And I think that's something that I know the Institute for Faith Work and Economics is working on, the Acton Institute, and a lot of these other organizations working at the intersection of economics and theology are saying let's look beyond merely caring about people, because we all care about people, or I assume that we do, and let's figure out what exactly needs to happen in order to improve the lives of the least of these among us.
Well, let me talk about that with your work at the Institutes of Faith, Work, and Justice, it is called, right?
No, Faith, Work, and Economics.
Faith, Work, and Economics, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that in the same breath as the Acton Institute, and we've had
right.
Robert Chirico on here in a past interview. We'll link up to that. What, in terms of getting theologians, these Catholic bishops, these other Protestant groups like Jim Wallis, the Sojourners, and say, hey, you need to learn the economics a little bit better. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I will be honest. I'm not 100% certain.
Mm.
I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of public speaking. I write regularly for Forbes, for the Washington Examiner. I'm working on a white paper for the Institute right now. That is, it's basically about these kinds of things. And on one of my student evaluations, actually, when I was at Rhodes College in Memphis, a student referred to me as almost an economic evangelist. Or an evangelical economist. I think that's one thing I do is try to bring the discussion back to, okay, how does this affect incentives? How does this affect incentives? How does this affect incentives?
But one of the things that you have, and I'm going to think like an economist here for a minute, is going back to comparative advantage and specialization. I mean, there's so, and what you were talking about, all these exabytes and gigabytes of information that we're producing nowadays, you know, a theologian has so much information they have to learn in seminary that they're not going to have time for economics. And therefore, even though they're studying theology, they still want to get into public policy debates based upon their Christian ethics, because it says, you know, thou shalt love and care for the poor, et cetera, the Beatitudes, the blessed are the poor, the Sermon on the Mount, the whole thing like that. I said, yeah, I feel I'm compelled to do this kind of stuff, but they don't have the time to take an economics course or even several economics courses because, wow, there's so much theology that they have to know in their 3 years in seminary school. How do you overcome that?
I would assume, or I think what it requires is a rhetoric of persuasion. You know, just to say, look, these are things that are essential. If we're going to understand social theory, if we're going to understand history, we have to know basic economics. Again, I study it, and so therefore I think it's the most important thing that that pretty much anybody can know. I think the rhetorical strategy in terms of helping to convince people that they need to know some economics is just constantly to point to the consequences of economically illiterate policies. Again, as I tell my students from time to time, look, I know you want to change the world. I do too. I'm quite frankly, I'm not terribly impressed that you want to change the world, that you want to make the world a better place, because everybody wants to do that. The key is, how exactly do we go about doing it? Are we doing it in a manner that is coherent and rational, or are we doing it in a way that might make us look good, but that actually ultimately kills people?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the consequences of the kinds of policies that people are espousing, like, again, price controls on gas generators, or minimum wages, or restrictions on international trade, or anti-sweatshop legislation, or so on and so forth, what we're actually doing, and this I think is a bitter and perhaps even an evil irony, is we're engaged in the oppression of exactly the people that we claim to care so much about. Now, I'm not a theologian, so I don't know about the degree to which we're going to be held accountable for that, but it's something that I find very, very sobering.
That's got to be a tough sell, though, and I'm fascinated by this issue of rhetoric, because you go and tell somebody that, and you say, you have really good intentions. I know you really want to help the people out there in Haiti with the donations of clothes, and you're out there in the church parking lot with your cardboard boxes packing them up, but wow, this is really going to help them. I mean, telling somebody that is got to be really hard, again, because you're telling them that their good intentions really might not be that good of consequences, and it's easy to mix those things up. So, I mean, do you have any experience? Because I face the same problem all the time in my classes. And, you know, when we get to the basic fundamentals of economics, we talk about self-interest, and students immediately, oh, self-interest is greed, and it's always bad, and you're such a I'm portrayed as the cruel, heartless individual in front of the classroom spewing this economic stuff. How do you do that? I mean, have you had personal experiences with converting some people in your own, church or your students?
I don't know about the conversion experiences, but just at least broadening the extent to which people think about stuff. I decided, so my pastor and I went to a Helping Without Hurting seminar a few months ago, and we were talking about things that we can do as churches to be more effective, and I thought, okay, fine, I'm going to go and shoot this sacred cow. And my hand went up. I said, cancel the Christmas toy drive and cancel the Christmas food drive.
Scrooge, you are Scrooge.
Right? Yes. Or worse, perhaps. But in fact, this is interesting. So last Christmas, with the holidays coming up, this might be useful. I wrote an article for Forbes called "Ruining Christmas: An Economist's Guide." And I linked to a piece by Matt Iglesias from Slate, basically saying why you should cancel your food drive. And it's because food drives are just so incredibly inefficient relative to any of a number of other things we could be doing in order to improve the lives of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get into the details now, but the opportunity cost of, or in other words, what we give up in order to do all of this either completely ineffective or at best marginally effective stuff is, I think, getting meaningfully involved in the lives of the people around us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, when you put it like that, I think people, it resonates a little bit more, because people come to understand that, no, it's not that the economists and the libertarians hate poor people. It's that they recognize perhaps that what we're doing is ineffective, and it comes at a great cost, in that things we'd be much better off like sitting down and talking to people rather than just ladling soup and boxing up clothes to ship to Haiti.
Yeah, or sending them that can of pumpkin mash that's about to expire.
Right. Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
the amount of pumpkin mash that I see in Thanksgiving food and Christmas food drives, and if you look at the expiration dates, people are going back and cleaning out their cupboards. I'm like, I wonder how this is really helping people. I think poor people in early December or around Christmas time must only eat that pumpkin mash that's about to expire. So.
Oh, probably so. Well, and this is something that Corbett and Fickert discuss in When Helping Hurts, is poverty is much more than just material. Poverty is much more than just material. It's social, it's spiritual, it's on a wide variety of other margins. And there's a sense in which you were almost being condescending and insulting, even perhaps with the best of intentions, when we take a paternalistic view that there's this gigantic lump of anonymous, abstract poor people out there in the world who need people like me to go and save them from themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very fuzzy intersection of economics and how people respond to incentives and good theology. Again, Corbett and Fickert discuss it in some detail and point out that a lot of times what we're doing is we're trying to solve the problem of material poverty, when in fact there are much, much, much deeper issues that we need to be addressing.
Now, you've mentioned a number of different authors throughout this podcast. We're going to link to a bunch of these, as well as I'm going to try to get a link to your article, Ruining Christmas, and Economist account, the article there. So I urge our listeners to visit our website and check out some of these links, because it will take the discussion further. But the one thing that I want to leave off with, and I do this with a lot of my guests, is have them reflect about where you think things are heading. Now, for you, you're involved in the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, and you have this evangelizing economist view saying, listen, if you really want to help people, let's get the incentives right. That's the thing, not just handing people pumpkin mash, but let's get the incentive right. Take a look, and you're young in your career. You're an assistant professor down there at Samford, and you have some influence over students. How do you think things are going? Do you think that the rhetoric is changing for the better? It's changing in ways that people are starting to realize, oh yeah, maybe we had the frame wrong. Maybe we weren't thinking about things properly. Or is this just going to be a constant ongoing battle that may be fruitless to fight here in the world? What's your thoughts on where things are heading here in the next decade or two?
That's a very, very good question. I think, so in terms of my church experience, so if you look at, say, churches that are part of the Acts 29 network, for example, or the church we went to when we lived in Memphis, Fellowship Memphis, or any of a number of places kind of like that, I think people are starting to wake up and recognize that it's about more than just caring about people in some abstract, lumpen sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting to really genuinely look for ways to get, again, meaningfully involved in the lives of people around them. I think with the onset of the internet age and with major changes in technology, it has never been easier, I think, to transmit information. It's never been easier for people to learn the ideas of good, solid, sound, basic economics.
But isn't it the obverse is true, that there's never been greater opportunities to learn the exact opposite? I mean, you're talking exobytes of information being produced every 10 minutes. Holy shnikey.
Yeah, that's a lot of information.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of garbage out there as well. In terms of changes in the relative cost of learning good ideas versus bad ideas. So I remember Henry Hazlitt once said that the problem is that the good ideas need to be relearned every generation. I think the degree to which we can reach out, though, with the good ideas is changing in a way. I think the change in the availability of good ideas is making them more accessible than with bad ideas. Because with bad ideas, these were already intuitive. But so therefore, changes in information technology would just kind of tell people a lot of things that they already thought they knew, or the things that they wanted to know already. Whereas today, just anybody who wants to can listen to this podcast and then can go and do a fairly extensive set of readings backing up what we've been discussing here.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, I don't really know necessarily whether whether in the long run, change in communication technology will lead to more very good ideas or more very bad ideas. My hunch, though, is that is basically that the relative price of good ideas is falling, and to adopt some good, sound, solid economic terminology there. And I would expect to see more good ideas going forward.
Well, that is a very optimistic way of leaving off with our podcast here. And that is what our podcast here, Research on Religion, is trying to do, is trying to make the cost of good ideas and interesting scholarship and debate more accessible to a broader audience. So I urge our audience that if you enjoyed this discussion, please check out our archives. We have over 125 other episodes that you may enjoy. And I also want to thank our guest, Art Carden, for being on Research on Religion today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.